Rancho Marietta Community Service District Personnel Committee, special meeting October 8th, 7:30 a.m. Item 2, since the meeting's just been called, discuss converting two non-exempt classifications to exempt classifications. Meeting, good morning.
Good morning, thank you. I'm going to refer us to the staff memo, which is also in the packet. And on page 3 of that, I have specific recommendations, including in this instance, in this item, there are three items that are included in the overall agenda and on the memo. And the first one is the conversion of two non-exempt, non-represented classifications to exempt classifications. And these are proposed for the chief plant officer, or operator, excuse me, sorry, I have some typos in this, and the utility supervisor, both of which currently earn overtime. The conversion is intended to eliminate the overtime, but build that amount into the salary in order to bring those compensation levels closer to comparable positions in the region. Both positions are considered to be responsible for 24-hour operations in their assigned areas of responsibility and to respond to emergency situations as required. The proposed increase is $1,000 per month for each classification, and staff recommends this be effective with the start of the November pay period. And I'm happy to answer any questions about that.
Okay, so that's chief plant operator and then utility supervisor.
Right.
Okay. Do you have an idea off the top of your head amount of overtime that we're paying for these two?
I think for the chief plant operator last year it was under 10K.
Okay.
And I think it was slightly lower for the utility supervisor.
Got it.
Is there a change to the way it's taxed, or are the tax consequences the same for us and for them as far as payroll taxes and withholdings?
The taxes are the same. I think what's involved is the pensionability. For one thing, I don't think overtime is pensionable.
It's not.
And so the $1,000 more per month is beneficial to the employees from a pension perspective, which is sort of the long view, but it's an important aspect of the formula for those employees. Plus, it helps to normalize our rate of pay with other CPOs and utility supervisors in the region. There's an ancillary issue which I didn't bring up in this memo, but our utility supervisor classification is a little bit of a misnomer, since our utility supervisor is really more a distribution expert, which utility supervisors are often in charge of parks and rec, kind of above ground facilities, and the distribution supervisor has a lot of responsibility for underground connections, which is a higher skill level, more difficult operation. And so I think at some point we should rename that, redo that classification, but I ran out of time to address that issue.
What would you call it other than utility
supervisor? Distribution supervisors. Yeah.
Any thoughts on this, Travis?
Plenty, but I'll just defer to.
I'd like to hear you, Travis. I mean, yeah. I think the intent is to give these positions, you know, their time back and compensate them appropriately for the time, the regular hours.
I feel, I'm not going to get in trouble for how I feel that this is a bad idea, because there are times when the chief plant operator has to cover on call because either staff's not available or staff's on vacation. I don't always have staff that have the certs or the experience to cover on-call. And so if the chief plan operator has to do it and he's on salary, you know, there's the $60 that they get just for being on call, which he would lose. He has to then pretty much, just like the on-call person, keep his, you know, he'd go out and do stuff, but, you know, he has to be available to things. So all of that is being lost, and then the time coming in. There is a good aspect to it, because if the chief plan operator, he can get his staff to be trained better if he's not coming in holding their hand all the time. But our positions on the pay scale, if you take my pay to a chief plan operator, we'll just say EID. He's got to have a water cert. I have to have a wastewater cert, a water cert, a distribution cert, and I'm still below where the other people are at. And so the overtime was there to actually entice a chief plan operator to stay, to come here and work, because of the lower pay scale. Now, the pay scale has gone up since, like, I took over this position. It has, but so have the other pay scales. For the amount of certs that both me and Ron have to have, if you know, you're taking away one of the incentives that are there. I did more than $10,000 in overtime last year. I don't know, but so the you know, there's going to be money lost, but then, you know, it's, you know, there's other things too. You know, obviously there's other benefits to being on salary. I just think that it's going to be hard to keep, you know, hire for this position, you know, somewhere down the line. I'm not saying I'm leaving, you know.
No, I understand.
There were reasons that this was done. And if you want to make this a salaried position, I personally feel that $1,000 a month is too low to compensate for the loss.
Throw me a number.
I myself would have started at 15, because that would help. Because if I have to do on call, I'm not going to get paid for it. If I have to come in, other than, you know, for emergency status, whatever, it's not getting paid. That's part of exempt. But you know, you've got to get at least somewhat close to what a person that makes, because we have staff turnover quite a bit, and a lot of times we're bringing in uncerted staff, and it could be years before we had to before they were able to do on call. There was a year me and Corey had to split on call for a whole year, just the two of us, because we were the only certain people that were able to do it. It's just, if it's going to be done, I feel that a little bit more to help ease it. Other than that, it's, you know, there are just times where I'm going to have to come in. It is what it is. You know, that's just part of the job. But there was a reason it was hourly all this time. So that's just my opinion. I hope I didn't just shoot myself in the foot.
I think what it comes down to is, what is it worth not to get the overtime? And you're saying $1,500, which instead of $12,000 is $18,000. So that's...
That puts you closer to the ballpark.
Closer to what you would have made with keeping it at overtime. Plus, and on top of that, you get the advantage of it being pensionable. So
right. Because you have like the flood, that the New Year's Eve flood. Okay. I was here for close to 40 hours. Okay. And so obviously it was everyone here as quickly as you can, get it done, whatever. And it's not like if I was salary, I'd say, hey guys, have at it. I'd be here just the same way. But I'd only get paid for 8 hours or 9 hours for that day, whatever. So things happen. Sometimes things are smooth. Then you go through Rancho Murrieta, and you know, then things happen. So
so it wouldn't affect you. You'd show up either way.
I show up either way.
What about what are we setting up for the future? I guess we need.
Say I retire in 5 years. You bring somebody in. Are they going to have the level of dedication that, you know, I insanely have to this place? Or are you not? And I know this sounds cliche, but people look at money when they're looking at jobs. That's why they work. And then they stay because they like the place, but they start because of the money. You know, and when you're in that kind of position or higher, certifications are needed.
Can I make a proposal? I had gotten a text from Donna because I over a weekend, a couple weekends back, I said, "What are the numbers?" And I have $10,000 for you, but I want to go back and do a multi-year analysis of the overtime and then come back with a different proposal, because there is no intention to short you or have you have any loss in pay. I think your dedication is certainly extraordinary and very much appreciated. And I think the goal here is to compensate you in a way that adds to the long-term benefit and also frees up your personal time so that you actually don't have to, you know, always be out here. And then additionally requires the development of a deeper bench so that the district is more resilient to absences or, you know, whatever crises are out there with regard to the need to have all those certifications. So I'd like to recommend that I be allowed to take it back and return with it another day with the numbers that show sort of a multi-year average, and then talk about it from there.
While you do that, if that's what we're going to go, is there a way to define the type of overtime? So an emergency to me may not be an emergency to you, right?
Correct.
Coming from the 911 side of the house. So I would task staff at all levels to define overtime, right? Is overtime the on-call because of our staffing that we have, right? Mm-hmm. Limited as it is. Versus we have a flood situation. We have whenever the pump, and we had to have somebody babysit for 24 hours. To me, there's almost two, maybe three types of overtime, right? One of the overtime is just because of staffing. So that's predictable because either certificates and or lack of staff, right? Then we have what would impact the district on multiple levels are our annual floods that we have. So that's a longer term than just the Sunday to Sunday overtime because of staffing levels, right? And then somewhere in between, because some of the conversation you brought up is exactly the conversation that the GM and I have had on this, where I think the intent is the right way to go, because you are leadership, and you should be salaried. The compensation between $1,000-$1,500 is minimal to me, versus the other issues that you've identified, because taking one step to get you, not you personally, but the position, gets us into a more leadership role, gets us more in line when you start looking at some of these monthly salary surveys. And then it's the backside of what is this organization going to be, and how is staff then ultimately utilized across the district? And then what does that look like for the long term? Because I agree with you. Some of what I discussed with the GM is really that continuity of operation and long term change of command. And what does that look like? Because again, my intent for sure was not to diminish your salary. By any means, but at the end of the day, what we're asking of staff, we're getting to a point of, and I'll pick on you, Travis, if we didn't have somebody as dedicated, where's the district at? Is that bringing on another employee? So what's the cost there, right? And so there comes that point in time where when we start putting so much towards overtime that we need to fill it with full-time position, right? And so there's that point of breakover. I just don't know where that breakover is at. The other is I answered my question on that one. Thank you.
There's also the thing of minimum certification required, you know, like for this district to run that wastewater plant, you have to have a wastewater 4 operator on staff, chief plant operator or higher. To run it on a daily basis, you have to have a plant operator, you have to have a wastewater 3 certified operator.
Right.
To be able to run it. Right now, that all encompasses me.
Right.
Period.
Right.
And that's what you're going to be asking for a chief plant operator. Because if you don't, then you have to hire a contract operator.
Right.
You know? Because the state requires minimums.
No. I get that 1,000%. And really, where we're at as a organization. Coming out of a sucking, swirly eddy of despair, we're just now trying to figure out what does tomorrow look like, right? And to me, this is a very good step of trying to figure out what does tomorrow look like, and then that then ultimately forces the district right to what you said, some of those require certificates. And then what is that training? Because, and please don't take this personal, but the shining light of this organization has been the water operations. Everything else is just been sucking, swirly, eddy of despair. So now we're just
Says a lot about my wastewater.
Exactly.
Wow. I won't take that personal, though.
No. And I told you not to in the beginning. So that's where now we're at a point where we can start looking at some of these things and getting us to a direction where we need to go. And I think this is just the first step of many that we just have not been able to get to. And when the GM brought it to my attention, I thought, and I still think it's a very good idea. Now it's just a matter of fine-tuning. And again, it's never comparables across the board, but at least get us in that range, right? And get us into now where the district has to actually focus and move forward on some issues. Because again, at the end of the day, we can't rely on two or three people to keep the organization going. We've got to have some depth and resiliency in this case, what would be certifications that are required.
Travis, can I just get a clarification on that?
Yes.
For the wastewater treatment plant, the wastewater 3 certification, that's required daily?
That's required daily to at least one plant operator 3, or sorry, one wastewater 3 be on site.
Uh-huh.
So during the week, that's covered.
Okay.
Weekends.
So, but is that
not so much?
Is that 12 months out of the year, or is that only when the wastewater treatment plant is operating?
That's when the tertiary. That is because there is a tertiary process here, even though it's not running. Mm-hmm. It is 12 months out of the year.
Okay, great.
So, because we are classified as a wastewater 3 facility.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
I do have a public comment. Are you ready to accept public comments, or do you want to wait till the end of this section? Director, maybe.
And no, we'll take it.
I also want to remind everybody that we have an 8 o'clock.
Meeting. Correct.
Okay.
Everybody meeting. Remind Tim.
John Merchant,
7:23. Hi, John. Can you speak in the microphone? Thank you, sir.
Did Patrick say this was okay? You don't meet the California exempt test with... You're really in a gray area here. I had 85 people in 6 locations, supervisors, non-supervisors, working supervisors versus white collar. There's a whole set of California personnel rules that tells you what you can do. It's not a matter of what you want to do or what you think is best for your employees. It's what the law says. And you need to review this because you don't meet the test, especially at the plant operator level. There's a whole section of that law that deals with what they classify in the law as white collar. It doesn't mean that you wear a shirt and tie to work, but it means the gray area between executive and working supervisor. Certainly somebody running a plant on a day-to-day basis doesn't meet this test. So before you do anything else, you need to get Patrick to review the law here, because this doesn't qualify. And I've been doing it for 40 years with a lot of employees, trying to do exactly what you're trying to do. It doesn't work.
I know we've had a conversation with Michael on this.
Yes, Michael Fridgie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Stockton has an exempt. Many other entities throughout the area have their chief plant operator as exempt. And actually, it's a great segue to the next topic, which is the paper for performance manual. And this is what brought it to my attention, because when I was reading through the pay for performance manual, everywhere the references were to the exempt employees, exempt, exempt, exempt.
Right.
And the chief plant operator and the utility supervisor were lumped in there, listed. So I went to our payroll specialist and I said, so what are the chief plant operator and the utility? Are they exempt or non-exempt? And she said, oh, they're non-exempt. And I said, well, this pay for performance manual references them as exempt. And she said, well, that's wrong. So that's what led me down the path of trying to figure out, like, what are these positions? Because they're included in a pay for performance manual that was historically first created in 2016, and yet the treatment of them is as a non-exempt that earns overtime. So I think regardless of what action we take, we need to have some clarity about, you know, what is the correct classification for this, for these two positions, because they are non-represented, they're supervisorial and managerial, and yet they're referenced as both exempt and then treated as non-exempt. So need to align those regardless of which way they fall out.
It's the most contested thing in California personnel.
That's
every day.
Okay.
I'll tell you, I've done it.
Well, that helps to explain the confusion on our paperwork.
Yeah, wholeheartedly, especially since it's been going on since way before 2016. So, and I don't know what the justification or process was in 2016 on how they came up with it or why they. I understand the why, I just don't understand the implementation of it. So, okay. Then I would ask that you follow up. And then once you get that information, we can reschedule a personnel committee meeting.
Okay.
And move it forward. I would like to keep this on the front burner for numerous reasons, a handful which we've already discussed, and then a couple of the items that Travis brought up.
Very good.
Where's my agenda? Item number three, discuss proposed changes, pay performance manual updates, non-represented salary, establish new non-represented executive management group. Mimi.
Okay, so I don't know how many folks have actually seen this pay for performance manual. It was never really shown on our website as a separate document. It was kind of nested inside of a like 100-page document on performance issues in October. So I pulled that out. I listened to the tapes from both the committee and the board meeting on October 21st to try to get an understanding of this. This document has I don't know what it is, like 50 pages, but it goes into extensive detail about the calculations and the various examples. And I found an old copy from some other GM from maybe 10 years ago that just blew my mind because his or her edits to the document just mirrored mine. This is so confusing. It's difficult to implement. It's and it included both represented and non-represented examples. So I tackled the task of trying to pull out the essence of the program and the manual. And so what you have is a much briefer document which has basically three main elements. One, an overview. Two, the components and implementation methodology, and then the requirement of an audit. And then the rest of it is all included in these exhibits from A to F. So essentially the pay for performance concept, the pay for performance program concept, has been around since 94, and then it started to be formalized with a policy in 12 and then this document in 2016, and then that document was updated in 21. But the essence of it are these four components that are listed on the table of contents. So you have a competitive base pay, so that is the first thing. Then the competitive benefits, then the possibility for a merit salary increase, and then some additional rewards and incentives. So the document itself really is not altered in any significant way. There are a couple of specific changes that I've got in my staff report that pull into that or add to the attachments, but essentially these components of the base pay, the benefits, the merit salary increase, and the additional rewards and incentives are unchanged. It's just the presentation is more clearly articulating what the pay for performance program looks like, and then the attachment describe how to implement them. So for example, the competitive base pay is based on ideally an every 3-year salary survey that looks at comparables throughout the region for the various positions. The last one was done in 2020 with seems like an update in 21. And then I think because the organization has had other issues as a result of sort of the financial disarray, that those salary surveys didn't get teed up. They were not a priority for the last year. So my proposal is to plan to get back on track by October 2025 for the salary surveys, and to adjust the non-represented salary schedule in January by 8% to kind of make up for the fact that that didn't happen. So that competitive base pay is very complicated. There was a consultant who was hired in 21, and I think previously for several years too, that did all of the analysis of the various represented and non-represented positions. And so that's a large job. And that document describes the methodology by which the salaries have established their ranges. And the ranges for the non-representeds are different than the ranges for the representeds. They don't have steps. They just have a minimum and then what they call a control point, sort of in the middle, and then a maximum. And so the salary survey tries to align the control point to the median in the marketplace. So that's all the competitive base pay. And then competitive benefits is sort of corresponding, but regarding the various indirect compensation that's provided to employees in the form of health care, retirement contributions, and life insurance, vision, all of the different types of benefits that are out there for employees. The merit salary increase is probably the most complicated component of the pay for performance program, and that's because the way that the percentage increase is implemented considers where the individual is on that range.
Right.
And then if they are below a certain point, they might get an augmentation that's added to their monthly pay. If the percentage increase pushes them beyond that maximum, the difference between that percentage and the maximum gets awarded as a one-time bonus. So that's all captured as an attachment. No changes to that. It's just parking it out someplace else so you can continue to keep up with the main thread of there are these four components. And then the fourth one is a variety of different rewards and incentives for example, safety or cost savings or other innovative kind of approaches that help to advance the mission. And that's sort of roughly the changes to the pay for performance.
Randy, any questions? This is an easier read than the current one, I can tell you that.
I don't know where to begin, so I think I'll just say no, I don't have any questions. I get it. We're just simplifying and making it easier to read for the most part. Correct?
Yeah, to make it an easier tool to utilize. The second item on here, on this agenda item, is to update the non-represented salary schedule. And that's a proposed increase of 8% to the 2025 schedule to address the delay in the triannual salary survey referenced in the 2021 manual. And it's sort of to make up for that. And I'd just like to clarify that increases to the salary schedules do not automatically result in increases to pay to staff. Increases are dependent upon performance evaluation and accomplishment of goals.
All that's doing is aligning the salary range.
Yes, it's just expanding that salary range.
Understood.
And then the third element of item two is the creation of a non-represented executive management group. There is currently one non-represented miscellaneous group, and staff is proposing the creation of a new non-represented executive management group to recognize the responsibilities and contributions of the upper leadership positions at the district. So the GM and the director of finance and administration, excuse me, I put that in wrong, would be included in the new executive management group. And this change is proposed to be retro to January 1 of 24 and to include discretionary, retroactive, and prospective pay increases. So a different treatment, and that will require a resolution that we would have for the board should they decide that that is a path that they want to pursue. And the document, the pay for performance document, has the various attachments, including the proposed non-represented salary schedules, which do include currently the proposed move of the non-exempt classifications. And so we can strike that and address that in the next one, so to remove that from the proposal, pending the review of the multi-years. Of overtime.
Right, just
would you have another public comment, sir?
Yeah, now it's a good time. I'm just taking notes.
Can I ask, is this something you're intending to bring here to the October board meeting?
Yeah, usually personnel meets, and then staff's given direction, and then it gets on that month's board.
So is there then, I guess my question, is there any modeling that goes with this that measures the impact of what this potentially could cost? I mean, I understand that, you know, you're expanding ranges, and ranges in themselves don't mean that that's an automatic increase in the payroll. There's also a part of this that shows that, and I've only seen this for 10 minutes, 8%, I think, is what you just said, for executive level, that's retroactive back to January. So I'm just wondering, is there any modeling that's going to happen that's going to attempt to measure what the impact of this would be on forthcoming budgets?
The answer to that would be yes, because it would be in the updated staff report. But that would be no different on any other negotiation that the district has, either with the GM or other employees moving forward. It would be the same impact if the local three negotiations that took place.
Yeah, but I guess my question is really relevant to what happens in a couple of weeks. Is all this going to like be there and be ready and be voted on in 2 weeks?
That's what I would anticipate.
If I could clarify, the 8% was for the non-represented miscellaneous, which is the confidential and other managerial, and that 8% would be altered in the salary schedule, but the pay-for-performance manual requires that evaluations of non-represented occurs in April and then is effective in May, and then the pay-for-performance manual under the guidelines for how you calculate that has a range of 0 to 6% potential increases to pay, and so it's unlikely that any employee would actually get the 8% just because of the way the guidelines are prepared. And you're talking about a total of, I forget how many it is, like maybe under 10 employees altogether, and so that diminishes the impact. Plus, we also have salary savings from unfilled positions in the non-represented group for the last almost 4 months.
Well, just
in this budget.
My last comment would be that what I picked up here, and again, I only had 10 minutes to read this, was at the non-representative executive management group. You're talking about retro to January 1 on the two highest salaries in the district. So I would imagine that there's a fiscal impact there. And if this is going to get presented in October, then I'd really like to understand that in the packet. And I'd like to see that, if it's possible, in the packet, you know, maybe like before I show up at the meeting like this. I mean, the only thing in the packet for any of this was the agenda. And, you know, that's a lot of stuff for 10 minutes. That's all I have.
And I'd like to reiterate that the pay for performance manual, the salary survey, when we had it the one time that we had it in the past, it wasn't like, oh, and so this is how much you can earn.
Yeah, no. It's the range that gets us to allow.
Yeah, it was definitely, though, I received that raise that next pay cycle. I started getting
right. We're just maxed out right now.
Up to my, where I was competitive in the market.
Understood. What I would like to do, and you can jump in, Randy, is, Mimi, I agree, where to go? I like the control points. I like how we have the range as identified. I do agree. Then on page 12, we pull the non-exempt classifications for two reasons. Really, what's the scope and manner of their job? And then two, what is the fiscal impact of the overtime? And then part of that overtime, then really, what is the percentage of their time to percentage of that operation's overtime, if that makes sense? Because the other things that, and similar to what John was talking about, but can't quantify, is really what are those certs, training, those ongoing costs. That's cost of doing business at the end of the day. So, and the district has not been good about figuring out what is the cost of doing business on a daily basis, because we do rely so much on the overtime, et cetera, and the limited staff we have. So. So I'll make a recommendation that with what we discussed, we make the modifications to the pay for performance and then put in a couple of the items that we discussed. And then I would still say put it on the board agenda as an action item. And then the board can make a decision if they're going to act on it or give direction, further direction to staff.
Okay, all right.
And then I would, because I know we've had conversation with Michael or legal counsel on, and it kind of goes back to Mr. Merchant's comment on how are we using two of the classifications appropriately as a district, and have we been? So. That's all I have.
Well, I concur. Let's move this. Let's move this item to the board. Table the the movement of the two to the non-represented, and at the board meeting, let's have some kind of analysis of the fiscal impact of this, so that we have that to look at as we look at this further.
Very good. Will do.
Okay. Thank you. Item number four, public comments. Do you have any, Amelia?
I was having
the other question. Okay. Randy, any other comments from directors?
I do not.
Thank you, Mimi. This has been lacking. We've been talking about it as a board for a while, to internally start looking at some of these things, some of the things you brought up, Travis. It's on our radar. We're just now getting to it. So we just have to work through what that process looks like moving forward. Because again, at the end of the day, how the district operates tomorrow isn't how it should be operating yesterday and today, quite honestly. And you live it more than most of us. So with that, I got nothing else. I move to close out the meeting, and you can start your 8 o'clock meeting, Mimi.
Thank you.
Thank you.